with you. This is Henrik, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. Okay, so today we have something different for you. We are going to talk about the esoteric system of money creation and double bookkeeping, also known as the Venetian method. This goes back to the ancient world, to Semitic cults and their belief in hermeticism, or magic, a sexual act of creating something out of nothing. We are going to talk about how all of this relates to how the bankers, the Semitic cult, still today rule us with debt in this same way, and double bookkeeping. Our guest is Colin McKay. He's an Australian entrepreneur who has been blogging on finance, economics, and Australian politics since 2010. He's also presented his own concept of an alternate currency ecosystem called the Deror. We'll talk more about this later in the show in the second hour. But before we begin, I wanted to make sure that you know that we are doing our live TV show this Saturday, April 30th, starting at 10 p.m. Central European time. This is 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific U.S. time. And this, for our Australian audience, becomes May 1st at 6 a.m. in the morning. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. But I do hope you can join us anyway. We are going to have guests, friends, callers, and talk about the launch of our new live TV show and also do a fundraiser. And we're going to explain more about this during the show as we have big goals and what our long-term plans are for the TV channel. Oh, and also the main reason why we're doing this is that Red Ice Radio is turning 10 years old. We have been doing this for a decade now. So we're going to have a 10-year anniversary, a birthday party for the radio program. We also have exclusive Red Ice t-shirts available, organic ones made by Lana's Llama. We have a bunch of fun stuff going on, so definitely don't miss it. And in the middle of all of this, we're also going to launch our new website. It will be completed pretty much any day now. There will be more information about the live show there. Info is already available on the members website, redicemembers.com/live. Go there if you're a member. But more information will be available on the website here any day now. You can also check our YouTube channel, youtube.com/redice radio, where the live event has been created. More information right there for you. Okay, let's get going. Let's get started on today's show. Hi, Colin. Thanks for coming on the show with us. Good to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
Yes, I am indeed. Thanks very much for inviting me.
You bet. So I'm going to kind of learn along quite a bit here today together with our audience. I briefly have looked at some of the work that you've done. And of course, we do have a proud tradition of looking at currencies, the economic problems, really, the system with the parasites of the banking class, with their central banks, and also actually the tie in with the occult or the hidden aspects of money creation and those related issues. And probably, you know, there's a lot more that you've weaved into the work, of course, that you've been doing. But I'm looking forward to hearing more about all of that. But first, Colin, tell us just a little bit about yourself and your interest in the topics that we'll be discussing today.
Okay, sure. Well, I guess there's not a lot that's of interest in on a personal level. I'm just a, you know, a country lad from regional area in New South Wales in Australia, I guess beginning around the early 2000s, I began to take an interest in monetary systems and the history of monetary systems. I have a personal interest an affinity with, you know, sort of searching for the truth of things and, you know, sort of concerns for injustices and so forth. And I was prompted, you know, by a political economic event in Australia in sort of late 2009, 2010 to begin blogging on finance and economics and politics in Australia, and did that for a number of years. And so, yeah, I guess that's my background. There's probably not a great deal more to say than that, really.
Sure. No problem. Yeah. No problem, Colin. Yeah. So obviously you wrote an essay called The Money Shot, Even Banking is All About Sex. It's on your website, psalmstis.com. And I know that you're writing a book on the subject, not only this subject, of course, but economy overall and the banking system and everything else. But give us a rundown, if you can, an overview from your perspective and some of the ideas that you're trying to convey before we kind of go into detail here.
Okay. Well, broadly speaking, the the thesis for the book that I'm presently writing is that the foundational concepts for both double entry bookkeeping and in turn the banking and monetary system, which is all based on double entry bookkeeping or double entry accounting, and in turn then economic theories of all shapes and sizes and so on, as well as social theories and so forth, that all of these, in terms of their foundational concepts, can in fact be traced back to ancient Semitic cults and the beliefs and worship practices in that time frame. So that's, in a nutshell, I guess you could say that's the thesis that I'm tracing in the book. Last year I published an essay, which is a precursor to the one that we're presently discussing, called On Principle and Interest, Hermetic Magic and the Lords of Time, which perhaps laid out some of my early research on this topic, and the present essay that we're looking at is a further development of my research and understanding of these topics.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. Tell us, I mean, for an outsider who might be tuning in who might not have heard many of the past show that we've done on the economic system and of course some of the work that you bring to the table here as well, but what overarching, what is the problem with the monetary system and money creation overall?
Well, there's many different ways that we can describe this.
Huge problem, I know.
Yes. Well, the fact that it is, certainly a central part of what I'm presenting is that it is, at its heart, it is fundamentally, it is fraudulent and based on trickery. This is done through mechanisms which can in fact be easily understood. These mechanisms, which are all built, and this is perhaps a point that I would really emphasize as it's central to the thesis, is that these are all mechanisms which are built around the concepts of double entry bookkeeping. And in fact, those concepts of double entry bookkeeping for people who perhaps have an interest in hermeticism and all manner of secret is perhaps a word I prefer to use as a perhaps less loaded term than occult. So mm-hmm. Secret knowledge.
Well, that's what it means, right? I mean, occult really means hidden, right? The moon or sun, the moon can be occulted by the sun if it goes behind it from our view, right? That's all it means.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly. So, I think there's probably a lot of your listeners would have quite a lot of understanding of some of these sorts of concepts, because they are sort of these concepts of equilibrium and the coincidence of opposites or the unity of opposites and so on are concepts which appear in all manner of secret or hidden knowledge. What I guess I'm presenting is that it is a combination of those of that knowledge, particularly built around the concept of the coincidence of opposites or the unity of opposites, syncretized or connected with other schools of thought in history, such as the Sophists, Neoplatonism, and so forth. Have been sort of combined together to create a system simply of trickery. It's discussed even within mainstream language. If you follow sort of economics and finance and so forth, mm-hmm. It's quite common even with mainstream commentators to refer to the alchemy of banking and finance or the magic of money or what have you at various times. Not often. The truth of it is that there is, in a sense, a magic about the way the system operates. But that magic is, in fact, trickery with the power of words. And that essentially is a central part of the thesis that I'm putting forward.
I've been interested in the question of creating something out of nothing, very, very concept of magic, that this is really what at least our modern money really has managed to achieve to a certain extent. But yet, can you tell us more about that?
Okay. Well, I guess maybe as a way of explaining this, you know, perhaps if verbally I perhaps try to go through with you an explanation of the way in which the double entry accounting system actually operates. In the sense of the way in which money, and I use sort of quotation marks around the word money, how that is in fact created out of nothing using double entry bookkeeping, maybe that perhaps would be sort of helpful for listeners, a way of explaining this in that double entry bookkeeping is something which, depending on the scholars that you study, can be traced back certainly to around the 12th, 13th century, and in limited forms, but it will certainly become much more formalized in the Renaissance, which in fact is actually known as the Hermetic Reformation, because the explosion of ideas within that period was very heavily influenced by the discovery and translation of the Corpus Hermeticum, and at that time, with the explosion of interest in a number of different schools of philosophy, a lot of different ideas were combined together from different schools, whether they were, whether they be Hermeticism, Kabbalism, and Neoplatonism, and so on. And out of that, the pre-existing forms of double entry bookkeeping, they were developed further and formalized, and most scholars attribute the seminal work on double entry bookkeeping to a chap called Luca Pacioli, who was a priest and a magician, shall we say, essentially in that period. The notion of abstraction is something that that became very a very powerful influencing force in the thinking of the times, and as I describe in the earlier essay that that I wrote, the essential idea of abstraction boiled down to taking a concept. And in the simplest form that you could imagine, and then dividing that idea or that object into two opposites, and that in essence, in a very that in essence is the basis of double entry bookkeeping, and in fact an awful lot of other ideas, sciences, the standard model of physics, and so forth. And so, in double entry bookkeeping, the fundamental rule in double entry bookkeeping is that for every credit there must be an equal and opposite debit. Mm-hmm. So every transaction that is entered into the ledger in double entry accounting is not entered in as a single entry. I spent $10 as an expense on this item. That single transaction of $10 spent on an item is entered into the double entry accounts as split into a $10 debit and a $10 credit assigned to a particular account. And perhaps without belaboring the point in our discussion here, those who are interested can perhaps go and read through my essays. What is embodied within the double entry bookkeeping system is the core concept of the coincidence of opposites.
Does this, do you think, come from a belief at the time when this was developed in how things were like in nature, how things really operated, or is it something which is more metaphysical, a spiritual concept steeped in, well, you mentioned, of course, hermeticism, but we have an kind of an alchemical process weaved into this as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. All of those concepts are, I guess, embedded or certainly influenced within the double entry bookkeeping system. And what I've touched upon in the essay, The Money Shot, is the fact that those concepts, those metaphysical concepts, those observations of nature and the apparent or the appearance of opposites within nature and the forces of nature can in fact be traced all the way back to the understandings and the ritual practices and so forth, the cuneiform writings and texts associated with in specific the ancient Semitic worship of the goddess Inanna, also known as Ishtar, and within the Greek culture later became Aphrodite and so forth. It's a whole string of connections that can be taken there. But it's what you're discussing there in terms of are these this notion of opposites and the coincidence of opposites, the meeting or the unity of opposites in a higher neutral nothing, shall we say, is something that can be traced all the way back to the worship practices of Inanna Ishtar.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because some of the first writing, I believe, that comes out in cuneiform and on the clay tablets, these small little things, and even on the rolls of scrolls, I guess it is, there is a lot of bookkeeping on them. There's a lot of receipts. There's a lot of, measurement. What do we have? How much do we have? These kinds of issues. But explain this a bit for someone who doesn't quite, know about this, who haven't followed this line of thinking of where this begins, the history of this, and why you think it arises to begin with.
Okay, well. If we go back to the depths of history that I've reached so far, then the goddess Inanna, also known as Ishtar, was the scholars tell us was an androgyne goddess, combining the forces or the principles of the female and the male, if we're thinking in terms of gender, but on a metaphysical, on a spiritual level, the forces of order and disorder, or creativity, sort of creative or active force, and the passive, the opposite. Passive force, and so, I certainly would imagine that a lot of the process that of observation of the peoples of that time that resulted in their deification of these particular characteristics within this goddess would have been as a result of observation of the forces of nature and the observation that there is the appearance of apparent good and apparent evil, or apparent creation and apparent destruction and so forth within nature. And so these characteristics are embodied within the goddess and within the worship practices, the writings and the texts associated with her activities, and so on. What I am identifying within that is that those fundamental underlying concepts, in specific the concept of the coincidence of opposites and the higher, those apparent opposites emanating from a nothing or neutral, shall we say, zone or a liminal zone, is something that certainly is very clearly identified in that period. And those same those same fundamental concepts also appear in all kinds of belief systems, traceable right through history and across all manner of different cultures. But they are quite clearly, in my view, are also very clearly embodied within double entry bookkeeping, and thus the actual mechanisms of the banking system, the money system, with the particular nuance which is critically important, that they are used in combination with the magic power of words to deceive. And that essentially is the way in which the double entry system, I've sort of shown in my earlier essay, is something that was formalized in the Renaissance, and there's abundant evidence for this, that it was a tool that was formalized specifically for the purposes of concealing or hiding what was at the time the illegal practice of lending money for gain. So
in Europe or earlier in the ancient world?
No, in Europe. So during the period of the Renaissance, the double entry bookkeeping was something in a more limited form, pre-existing, dating back, if memory serves, as early as around the 11 or 1200s. But certainly with the discovery and the translation of the Corpus Hermeticum and the explosion of interest in hermetic concepts, the double entry system was, and in specific, what is referred to as the Venetian method of double entry accounting, was formalized by the merchants, formalized for the use of the merchants of Venice, for the specific purpose of concealing the practice of lending money for gain or usury, which with the church being the dominant power at that time, viewing it as something that was both immoral and a mortal sin, to practice lending money for gain had to be done in such a way that it could be justified or concealed from the authorities, and so the formalization of the, in specific, the Venetian method of double entry bookkeeping in the Hermetic Reformation or the Renaissance was, the evidence is very solid that it was for that specific purpose, was to serve as a means for concealing the practice of lending money for gain.
Interesting. So, in the 1400s, really, this is beginning to entering into Europe then?
Yeah, I once again, if memory serves, it was somewhere around 1460, 1470, something like that,
right.
the Corpus Hermeticum was translated.
Yeah.
And prior to that, there was a lot of interest, and there's plenty of evidence that hermetic alchemical concepts and so forth were well known, and there was a lot of interest in those for hundreds of years prior. But it was certainly the translation of the Corpus Hermeticum that resulted in sort of an explosion of interest in these things, and the scholarly view. I think there's a solid case can be made that the expulsion of the Jewish people from Spain in the same century, many of them coming to Italy, northern Italy and Venice and so forth, and bringing with them Kabbalist ideas and understandings, all of these things in that sort of explosion of interest in ideas meant that that there was a lot of sort of mixing of ideas and concepts by sort of philosophers. Interestingly enough, many of them, in fact, actually can be shown funded by the big banking families at the time,
mm-hmm.
Such as the Medici family. You know, it's interesting. For example, you know, a lot of people aren't aware that the first weakening of the church's anti-usury laws, in fact, occurred in May of 1515 under Pope Leo X, who was in fact the first Medici family member to become a pope. There's an interesting connection there. I'm told by Jane Gleason White, who authored a book called Double Entry, that Luca Pacioli, the priest and sort of magician who is credited with writing the seminal book of the Venetian method, Double Entry Bookkeeping, that he in fact was given his chair of mathematics in Rome by Pope Leo X. So mm-hmm. It's a very interesting period of time. There was a lot of very powerful ideas that have resulted in where we are. The systems that we have today, the beliefs and notions that we have today, and the systems that we have today, all stem from that sort of explosion of interest in ideas and knowledge in that period of the Renaissance. And when you dig into that, you find that an awful lot of the ideas and the systems that came from that period were as a result of patronage by banking families.
Yeah, I mean, the Medici, they really, as you explained, they really bring forward economically. They help fund a lot of the art and whatnot that explodes at the time. And it's really also a kind of, this comes out of the creative environment of the Corpus Hermeticum, really, you know. And this is, it's a very interesting period. But this is obviously like the shadow side of all of this, right? Because we're obviously suffering immensely under this system of debt today. Interest, debt-based money, etc. Tell us a bit more about double entry. Explain that to people who don't. I don't know how that works.
Okay. It's something that's quite sort of difficult to explain without sort of resort to diagrams. But you know, as we sort of earlier sort of touched on briefly, and I confess I struggled a little with attempting the explanation. The most important, perhaps basic concept for someone who's not at all familiar with double entry bookkeeping is to understand that every entry into the ledger of a transaction, whether that's a receipt of money or an expenditure of money, is not simply entered as a single item. That transaction, whether it's an outgoing of money or an incoming of money, is entered into the accounts split into two halves, if you will, a plus and a minus half. And it's within that that obviously the fundamental concept of the coincidence of opposites or the unity of opposites lies. And it's also the heart of where the deception is able to occur. I'm just racking my brain at the moment to think how I might be able to verbally describe that.
Should we refer a bit to the images that we're going to have up on the website, maybe?
Yeah, I think that's probably very helpful. I mean, in the understanding of the way the money creation process happens within double entry bookkeeping, perhaps the most important initial concept isn't necessarily related to double entry itself, but in the understanding that money is created on the back of the signing of a loan contract, so an agreement between two people to have an exchange. So on the simplest level, most of us would think, okay, well, that's a simple agreement. We're signing a contract and the terms of that contract are that the banker is going to give me money and I'm agreeing in under that contract to pay them back some money. If we think about it a little bit more clearly, there's actually an exchange, if you will, a two-sided exchange being agreed to in that loan contract. There is a promise being made on the part of the banker or the money lender that they are going to give you money.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half of that agreement is that you are promising in turn to pay back the banker the same amount of money, the principal amount of money, and naturally enough, where we come to the the critical issue of additional monies, the the payment of interest or what was always originally known as usury, that is obviously an additional amount that you are promising to pay back to the banker. Now, if listeners have a look at the diagrams that are part of my essays and some of those diagrams are displayed on your site, it will help to understand the two-sided nature of the process, which is perfectly or very precisely represented by the double triangle of Solomon or the hexagram, which is a I'm sure is a symbol that listeners will be very familiar with.
I believe so.
And
if not, go look at the image, folks. We'll have it up on the program page. So do take a look. Follow along here, by the way.
Yeah. So if in looking at those diagrams, and so you imagine yourself as the borrower of money, and you are the person who is who is looking upwards at an inverted triangle. You're looking up from the pointy end, and so on your right hand, you are promising to pay. You are incurring a liability. You are promising to pay the banker money. And that promise to pay on your part, to pay money back to the banker, is considered within the double entry system. That is a liability, and that sits in the formal principles of the way double entry accounting work. That sits on the right hand side of the ledger. On the left hand side of the ledger, is an asset. And that asset is the promise to pay that the banker has made to you. They're going to give you money. So in your double entry account, if you will, you have on your left hand an asset being the promise that the banker has made to give you money. And on your right hand, you have a liability, a promise that you have made to pay the money back to the banker. Flipping all of that over to the opposite side, exactly the same thing. So if you were to imagine spinning that triangle back to the to the pyramid form as you look at it, then the perspective from the top of the pyramid, looking down from above, is the perspective of the lender or the money lender. And exactly the same rule of assets on the left and liabilities on the right applies to the banker. So he is looking down from above, and on his left hand is what he considers to be his asset, and that is your promise to pay him back the money mm-hmm. that he's lending you. And on his right hand is his liability, which is his promise to pay you money. And that symbolism encompasses the totality of both the double entry bookkeeping system, and also the complete perspective of the two opposites in the transaction that is being undertaken in the process of money creation.
This is a very occult idea, of course, in terms of trying to understand the process, but also interpreting it in a symbolic nature, of course. And of course, it's a very charged symbol too. It goes back to the ancient world, and you talked about the, if you will, the Semitic origins of this. What else should we know about that, and how that is used against us? So you're saying this system that was created in the ancient world, carried into, or maybe reformed and even further implemented in the Venice era, is still with us today, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what is represented there, perfectly precisely, is in fact the manner in which the system works. There's a few more details that we will need to touch on. I should sort of clarify that when I'm saying that this is a system which can be traced back to the ancient world, what I'm speaking of is the underlying core concepts
right.
of the coincidence of opposites, and more specifically, which I think is important for us to go into, is the notion of the inversion of values. Mm-hmm. In the worship practice, the texts associated with the worship of the goddess Inanna or Ishtar, the the texts and the scholarly interpretations of this tell us that the ritual practices involved in the worship of the goddess were essentially the ritualized inversion of traditional norms. So traditional gender roles. Male and female. The division between species. Human and animal, and so forth. All of these quite correct understandings of the natural world were identified at that time, and in the ritual worship practices associated with the goddess, these traditional norms, these traditional understandings and values, if you will, they were inverted in that process. Cult worship practitioners would, males dressing as females and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Evidence shows that from what's called the games text, for example, that adults would participate in children's games and so forth. All of these things, many of which are still with us today, for example, things like jump rope and hide and seek and so forth, can all be traced back to the games text in the ritual worship practices of Inanna Ishtar. And the important thing, to identify in that is that those worship practices were something that were very carnivalesque and very much associated with the idea of inverting normal or traditional or natural values. And the reason for that is the view that the opposites that we observe in nature these forces within nature are things that can be brought under control, in particular the more damaging forces. And so this is something that's quite important to understand, is that the goddess was viewed as being the goddess of love or sexual activity and war, that she embodied within herself these chaotic forces of disorder. And so the scholarly literature sort of suggests to us that perhaps the reason for these ritual worship practices, the inversion of values in the process of the worship of the goddess, was in honor of the goddess, was viewed as a way of neutralizing those disorderly powers that bring destruction upon us and chaos and so forth. So this is something that I think that's quite important to understand, is that while perhaps at that time the idea was to engage in certain activities of inverting values as a way of trying to control and limit, if you will, sort of limit or neutralize chaotic or disordering forces within society. And it's also suggested, that those also serve those carnivalesque activities and ritual worship practices also serve the purpose of reminding people, in fact, of the existence of the norms of what is traditional and what is orderly, by the very act of having these festivals, deliberately inverting all of those values, what we can learn from that is that these systems that whose underlying concepts can be traced there are now used deliberately for the purpose of, in fact, encouraging disorder, for changing or altering society's views of what is normal, traditional, natural behavior in all kinds of different ways. And we could probably spend hours discussing those things alone.
So this is, I guess, the
central part of the thesis, and where we look at the issue of double entry bookkeeping and these underlying concepts within the Renaissance period and the combination of different, you know, if you will, wisdom schools. You know, how much is wisdom and how much is manipulation and trickery, I think, is something that is, you know, we should be sort of quite cautious about. But, you know, the outtake from that is that, yeah, during that period, that, you know, that the explosion of knowledge of these different things, these different ideas and philosophies and concepts resulted in powerful people being able to, and we're specifically talking about moneylenders, being able to come up with ways in which to conceal the practice of manipulation of other people, and in specific, you know, for the purposes of gaining, you know, sort of financial power and control, you know, through, in specific, you know, the hiding of the practice of usury, or, you know, sort of lending money for gain, is what happened at the time. But that is, you know, that has since extended now to a, you know, a system which really sort of completely controls.
Very interesting. So, you know, on top of all of this, of course, and we'll talk more about how this, you know, how this works and how, you know, how, where we are today in relation to all this, but this really is a sexual act. And I mean, I've heard that, of course, the triangle or the seal of Solomon that you mentioned can be kind of broken down in that way, that it has to do with the upward or the erect phallus and the downward triangle or the vagina, or we get it in other traditions too, like the chalice and the blade, or the yoni and the lingam, I believe, in Hindu tradition. So that it's an ancient kind of idea and symbol, but the main core of this is that it's a sexual act, and it's that which is actually creating something new, right? That's why it's associated with sexuality.
Precisely, yeah. There's a crossover there to, you know, to the symbolism used obviously within Freemasonry, for example, where, you know, they, you know, rather than perhaps using the, you know, although they do use the hexagram as well, but, you know, with using the compass and the square, to symbolize, once again, to, you know, to symbolize the same thing. That's correct. Yeah. All of you know, the uses of this symbolism is unquestionably is of a sexual nature, and ultimately relates to, if you know, if you will, this concept that, you know, can be traced back thousands of years, yeah, if you will, battle of the sexes, and, you know, the, you know, which, the desire to, you know, to have one principle or one, you know, principle, whether it's the female principle or the male principle, you know, within different sort of cultures or systems or what have you, be viewed as the dominant one, and it's quite critical to the understanding, in fact, of you know, the double entry system and what's being symbolized there, you know, which I sort of go into, and in fact is actually part of the choice of the title, The Money Shot, you know, which is a, you know, it, from my perspective, is a cryptic reference to the fact that the heart of the trickery within the double entry bookkeeping based money, and, you know, use the term money in quotation marks, money creation system, is that money, in fact, is not actually, or the liability that the banker has promised to discharge by giving you money is not, in fact, discharged.
Mm-hmm.
The key to understanding is that there is mutual obligations involved in that sacred marriage, or that act of an agreement to make an exchange. You know, the lender lending money, and the borrower, you know, paying the money back, and the way that's being symbolized, or the way that's symbolized or represented, in the double triangle of Solomon, obviously, is that, you know, is the male phallic symbol has made a promise to discharge the principle, the substance, or the essence, to the female, or the receiving, you know, if you will, passive principle, and in return she is, you know, as part of her you know, sacred obligations, is going to repay the male principle with the first fruits of her labor, a firstborn child, you know, monetary child is really what we're talking about here. And where the deception in the way the money system works actually occurs, is that and as is shown in my essay, and is also brilliantly proven by a Professor Richard Werner, is that within the way that our money system works, the banker does not in fact discharge his liability. He in fact engages in word trickery or word magic or speech magic to quite simply to engage in an act of alchemy to transform by using a different name, quite simply, his liability to the receiving party, to the borrower, such that what you receive or what you believe to be money in your bank account, supposedly lent to you by the bank, is not in fact actually from a legal perspective, and this is very important, from a legal perspective, is not in fact money. It is not an actual discharge of the liability of the bank. The bank in fact still owes you money. What your bank account is quite simply is a record of the banker's promise to pay, of their promise to discharge the liability to you, and how this works is described both through the use of the hexagram diagrams and also through reference to the work of Professor Werner and the tales from some of his papers.
Yeah, is there anything more you can say about his work? I'm not familiar with it, but it does, I guess, underline some of the things that you pulled out in your essay and in your work.
Sure. Well, from my perspective, Professor Werner Professor Werner, I'm not 100% sure what is the correct pronunciation, in my view, is one of the very few economists in the world who actually practices science, in that his research, you know, is done by the inductive method, you know, rather than the deductive method, which is essentially what all, you know, sort of all economics really operates on the basis of sort of deductive reasoning, he worked for quite some time in Japan, and he has written a book which I believe was a bestseller in Japan called Princes of the Yen, with regard to the way the Central Bank of Japan has worked and operated essentially from the, you know, the period after the Second World War right through to the, you know, to the, you know, to the, you know, through the period of the growth of the Japanese economy into an industrial manufacturing power, to then the transition to a real estate bubble economy, and then that bubble economy, you know, exploding and collapsing, and he, you know, without sort of going into all the details, it's far better perhaps if sort of listeners go and watch the documentary that was made on the basis of his book, called Princes of the Yen, which is on YouTube. He exposes very well that it is quite possible, and in fact, the Central Bank of Japan is a perfect example of the fact that the power to create credit is a tremendous power which can be used for very positive purposes. If the creation of credit is done for directing to genuinely productive industry, you know, that it doesn't result in, you know, as is, you know, sort of the popular mythology that if you create money from nothing, then automatically, you know, there will be, you know, inflation and rising prices, and it's a terrible thing. So banks should, you know, central banks should never print money or create money from nothing, and so forth. All these things are false. You know, the power to create money or credit from nothing is in fact a wonderful power if used correctly. And so his research, his work, his book and his documentary and the subsequent papers he's been publishing for, you know, for decades are simply fantastic, and I can't recommend them highly enough.
Now you had of course a speech by Dr. Werner speaking in Moscow on the central bank issue that we can link to, but what you're referencing to is another film altogether about his work, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. In my essay, at the beginning of the essay that I had published on my blog, I reference a section in a lecture that Professor Werner gave at the Russian Academy of Sciences, where he, in a matter of a few minutes, brilliantly explains how, in fact, from a legal perspective, which is very, very important, how from a legal perspective the money system actually works. And so our understanding of money and banking and what we actually have or do not have in our bank accounts is completely different from the legal reality. This idea that we believe we have that, say for myself, I have no debt. But money that I may have in the bank, which I believe that is real money and that I own that money, it's not in fact true. Legally, it is not my money. I am in fact a creditor of the bank. The bank in fact owns that money, and the legal reality of that all stems back to the double entry bookkeeping process and this critical step in the lending process where the liability of the bank to discharge their promise to you to pay you money is not in fact discharged. They instead simply perform a magical act, an act of alchemy. They transform their liability, their promise to pay or their IOU to you from, in the language of double entry, from being an accounts payable, so an account that they are, that they have to pay to you, they transform that into a client deposit. And so from your perspective, you look at your bank account, after you've, signed a loan contract with the bank and you believe that the bank has now put money in your bank account and you believe that's money and you use that and you engage in the economy and you buy things and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it, in fact, from a legal perspective, from a practical perspective, you are able to operate within the economy on the basis of the belief that what you have is money. But in fact, it's not in fact money, and you don't in fact own it. It is an act of magic.
It's amazing that this really hasn't gotten out there more. I mean, the alternative media has covered this for many years now. There's excellent documentaries. There are many people talking about it, but on a larger scale, it's not really focused on, right? Because I asked this question years ago, and at that point we did far maybe more shows on the economy and the banking system than we have done the last year or so. But, I guess it just comes down to the fact that the controllers and ultimately in the extension, the bankers themselves doesn't want this to get out there. But this is obviously one guy that actually is speaking about it then, which is good.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the papers that I've recommended that you post on your site for listeners to go and have a look at is by Professor Werner. I believe it's the paper titled "A Lost Century in Economics." And I just mentioned for the purposes of listeners, please, when it comes to Professor Werner's work and his actual papers, don't feel phased that it's going to be full of complicated terms and language and something that's unapproachable for someone who's not familiar with this. Even his academic papers are written in a manner which I personally think are quite approachable for anybody. And so when it comes to that particular paper, "A Lost Century in Economics," what he covers amongst other things within that particular paper is the fact that the academic institutions, the leading lights of economic academia, certainly the central banks, and so forth. While he doesn't say so directly, you can certainly read between the lines that over the last century that they have conspired to hide from public view the way in which the money and banking system and the economy actually works in truth, because the fact that banks create money out of nothing in the act of lending, that the so-called money supply is created from nothing when banks extend a loan, and that they don't in fact act, as is popularly believed, as intermediaries between savers and borrowers, mm-hmm. that this knowledge, this was something that was very well known 100 years ago. And it's sort of very interesting, sort of studying the history of money and you know, sort of ructions in economies and discussion in the popular press and within academia of these things. That, you know, this is something that was known 100 years ago, and it's been right. and it's been carefully. It's been essentially carefully concealed through all manner of different mechanisms, you know, even ones as simple as creating a something which has come to be known as the as a Nobel Prize for Economics, which is in fact not really anything to do with the Nobel Committee. It's something that was financed by the Swedish Central Bank, for example, as a means of elevating the views of academics in relation to the banking and money system, whose views are wrong.
I believe that the Swedish Central Bank, Sveriges Riksbank, is actually the oldest central bank in the world, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's correct, yeah. Yes. That's
Which right. is interesting, yeah. Very, very interesting.
It is indeed, yeah, that's right.
You know, one thing, and we're going to take a break a little bit here, but one of the things that occurs to me, of course, is that if we just go back for a moment again and talk about the fact that the Catholic Church at the time seemed to have an ability to, well, protect itself from usury. This was looked down upon. They were kind of inoculated against these practices. No, not quite?
Well, it's a little more complex than that.
Right. It always is, isn't it?
it is indeed. Well, I mean, it certainly there are those who would argue that, you know, that the Catholic Church is something that's always been, you know, on a very strong moral pedestal when it comes to the, you know, to the practice of money lending for gain, and has always been very consistent and so on and so forth. And it's, well, from my perspective and my research, it's utter rot. That, you know, that while on an official level the practice of lending money for gain was, you know, prescribed and sanctioned, and, you know, this is something that's not allowed to happen, that senior clerics in particular, you know, within the church were very heavily involved in money lending themselves. If, you know, often, for example, they were, you know, using the proceeds from the operation of their parishes, or I'm not an expert on this, you know, the correct terminology for their local fiefdoms or what have you, but, you know, sort of various cardinals and so forth, or in fact, was sort of the evidence, I think, suggests that, you know, sort of rife within the Catholic Church was you know, the problem of clerics of all manner of different levels, but particularly, you know, perhaps more senior ones, being involved surreptitiously in money lending, even if, rather than doing so directly themselves or through people who were able to be connected with them, by putting the money that they had available to them to the Jewish money lenders. You know,
so this is kind of what you explained earlier, right? With the fact that the Medici's really brought this into the church at the time. They started kind of that tradition, while at the same time, officially, outwardly, they were against this, and you couldn't do these things, right?
I wouldn't 100% sort of nail it down to being able to say that it was specifically the Medicis who were to blame. There was various banking families, both, you know, sort of within Florence, obviously, which was, you know, sort of the home of the Medicis.
The Borgias, right? The Borgias was another powerful family.
Yeah. Precisely, yeah. This whole process of the question mark about the official stance and the unofficial stance in relation to lending money for gain, you know, sort of within, within the Catholic Church, and something is, you know, sort of, you know, is something that really has to be looked at in the context of many, many, many hundreds of years of history.
Sure.
But
sorry to interrupt, Colin, but let's touch upon this point here, though, before we take a break. And it was more, I guess, what I more wanted to get to is the fact that this transformed the fact is that the environment in Europe changed, and at some point, and I'm not, you know, maybe you know this, it went from more or less being looked down upon to being a practice which many different countries did, basically. And this is, of course, kind of run by when some of the central banks and whatnot move in. But is there any kind of clear indication what kind of turned the tide, or how they went from at least officially kind of looking down on that practice to practicing it?
Well, from my perspective, from the research that I've done, it seems to me that period of the late Renaissance, you know, the sort of late 1400s through sort of mid 1500s is really the critical period, because a combination of a couple of things, obviously that explosion of knowledge and information relating to, you know, the Hermetica and the, you know, the influence of Kabbalism and a variety and Neoplatonism and a bunch of different, I guess, schools of philosophy and understanding that came out of that period, combining together specifically in the formalization of the Venetian method of double entry bookkeeping, and that being then sort of if you will, I guess you could, you know, perhaps argue being promoted in a sense from the highest level. You know, as I was saying, the man who, as it were, wrote the book on the Venetian method of double entry bookkeeping, Luca Pacioli, was his patron, the first Medici Pope, Leo X, gave him his chair of mathematics at the University of Rome, and so. The combination of the ability to conceal the practice of money lending through for gain, or the practice of usury, which was still officially by the church, considered to be a mortal sin and you can't be done, that specifically the Venetian method of double entry bookkeeping enabled the concealment of that practice, which is very critical from the point of view of especially from the very wealthy bankers, because, you know, under church law, if you were considered a usurer, well, when you died, well, then you were under sort of canon law, as I understand it, it was considered that your heirs could not receive, you know, the inheritance of your money, because it had been achieved through the act of usury. So it was very important to be able to present, as it were, proof that your wealth had not been acquired through usury. And that's obviously, you know, that's where, you know, the evidence shows that the double entry bookkeeping system came into play there. And then more specifically, the turning point event, I think, which I referred to before, when Leo X, I guess you could say, first weakened the official position of the church on the practice of usury in 1515, where essentially what his proclamation gave license for essentially what were called charitable banks operated by the clerics. So essentially, official church sanction for practicing usury if it was being done for charitable purposes to help the poor by these banks that were being operated by clerics. And, you know, the argument is made by some scholars that action was taken of weakening, if you will, the official position of the church on money lending for gain because of this problem of clerics being involved in money lending for gain themselves, being such a problem rife within the church and such a source of controversy for quite a long time. And so it was considered that was a way of, if you will, sweeping the problem under the carpet by saying that, you know, that these cleric run supposedly, you know, sort of charitable banks were morally okay, and the church was okay with those. Now, my personal position is, there are some scholars who argue that those charitable banks by the church were a good thing. It's a very sort of complicated area. There are others who argue no, that they weren't, and so, you know, the very rigid kind of view with regard to money lending for gain should have applied and stayed consistent. I think it's fine for it to be considered an open question. I think the more important observation to be made is simply that was the point in 1515 when conveniently a Medici Pope made a decision to alter the official position of the church when it came to lending money for gain, at a time when also this mechanism for but only in the case of the if you will, the cleric or church-run charitable banks. Mm-hmm. So for everyone else, it was still verboten.
Right, of course.
And at the same time, you know, this wonderful new mechanism, you know, the Venetian method of double entry bookkeeping had been developed. I think that really was the turning point, that period, you know, the late 1400s through mid 1500s.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot to, of course, say about this, and we have many more things we want to get into in the second half, and continue to talk about your essay, of course, your upcoming book, and everything else. But give us a bit of more information about some of the other things that you're working on. If you want to mention the, see if I can pronounce this. Is it Doro?
I mean, I personally pronounce it, you know, sort of quite quickly as Draw.
All right.
Yeah, but you know, I understand that you know, perhaps it could be sort of pronounced in many different ways. That's an alternate currency system concept that I developed and first presented a number of years ago. And in many respects, and you know, I hope actually we'll be able to go into a little bit more detail in the second half. In many respects, it's a design for a currency system. Which I believe is a if you will, an antithesis or a you know, direct antidote for the way in which the present monetary system works. And you know, perhaps we can sort of go into details, and I can explain how that works and draw the direct comparison back to the way the present system works.
Yeah, exactly. Let's definitely go into more detail. Give us a website for that where people can find a bit more information, and also your blog where you have the essays and everything else.
Yeah, sure. Well, the alternate currency system website is Deror, D-E-R-O-R, Deror.org, and my personal blog where these essays that we're discussing have been published is Psalmistus. So Psalm, as in the Book of Psalms, Psalmistus, P-S-A-L-M. I-S-T-I-C-E, psalmistus.com.
All right, very good. Can people find you on Twitter, Facebook, anything like that? Is there anything you want to give out?
Yeah, sure. On Twitter, I probably spend far too much time on Twitter than I should.
Some do.
Yeah, indeed. Particularly of late, as you know, sort of putting out these essays and so forth. My Twitter account is drawcurrency. So at Draw Currency.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, you know, I saw some people have like 70,000 tweets. You know, I just like, what do you do during the day? Is that all you do? Is it, do you get paid to tweet? It's like, it's amazing amounts. But anyway, it is a place to spend some time or waste some time, that's for sure. All right, well, Colin, we'll take a short break here and then we'll pick up in the second hour. I want to hear more about the history of this. I want to hear more about, of course, how this applies, you know, today and how we truly kind of suffer under the system before we move on and talk about some of the solutions then, of course, that you have in terms of the drawer. So let's get into that. But we'll take a short break. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. Stay with us, Colin. We will return shortly.
Must be funny in the rich man's club.
As you know, if you're a regular listener, second hour is coming up. We're going to continue to discuss the topic at hand with Colin McKay about alternative currencies and the origins of the money creation system. We're going to talk more about the DeRoor, the alternate currency ecosystem, and pick that apart and see what makes it tick. It's an interesting continuation, so definitely don't miss it. But as we begin the second hour, we are going to close off the subject on how Semitic cults rule the banking system with double-entry bookkeeping. When you want to hear the second hour of this or any of our previous shows, go to redeyesmembers.com and sign up for a membership with us right there. All right, we'll take a short break right here. We'll be right back with the second hour. But don't miss the live show this Saturday. I'll keep reminding you about that. But we'll take a short break. We'll be right back.